Welcome to Zero Knowledge, a podcast where we explore the latest in blockchain technology and the decentralized web. The show is hosted by me, Anna.
And me, Frederick. In this episode, we sit down with Nigel Smart, professor in cryptology, to talk about multi-party computation.
Before we start, we want to say thank you to this week's sponsor, Starkware. Starkware will be putting together the Starkware Sessions in Tel Aviv on September 16th. The event will be bringing together the brightest minds in the field of zero-knowledge proofs from both the academic and application arenas. Topics that will be discussed are self-custodial trading, Starks for Layer 1, Stark-friendly hash functions, and other cool things you can do with Stark proofs. Also, I will be hosting one of the stages. So if you're interested in this exciting, cutting-edge tech, do join the Starkware Sessions. Or come a day early for the Stark 101 workshop, where you could build a Stark prover from scratch. Use the code ZKPODCAST to get 20% off any ticket. We have about 50 of these available, so get it fast. So again, thank you, Starkware, for supporting this podcast. And now, here's our interview with Nigel Smart.
So we want to sit down today and talk about MPC systems. And we have one of the possibly best guests to do so, Nigel Smart, professor at cryptology at KU Leuven and the co-founder of Unbound Tech. Welcome to the show, Nigel.
Oh, welcome. Nice to be here.
And we have Anna with us as usual. Hello.
Hello.
So to kick it off, Nigel, if you can think back to when you first started in this space, what is it about cryptography that really got you excited and wanted to work in this space?
Okay, so originally I trained as a mathematician and then I realized there really wasn't much money in that. And so it was much easier if you're doing this kind of maths I was doing and you go, I want to make money or I don't want to be poor. Then what you do is you do cryptography, which in those days in the mid 90s was just beginning to be deployed, everywhere because the internet had just started, etc.
I know a lot of people who got into cryptography through like the military. So either through in Sweden, we have like this thing you go through for a year and a half or something. They get into through that. Did you ever have that exposure to like the military side of it?
Not really. Of course, when you turn up at all the international conferences, there are various people from various government agencies there, some with three-letter acronyms and some with four, some with five, depending on the country. And they always try and pretend they're not there, but they are. And so you kind of get to see these people.
Yeah.
So I have a question about what you're working on right now, because you're a professor of cryptology, not cryptography?
Yeah.
What is the difference between those two things?
Okay, so cryptology is the science of making and breaking ciphers. So cryptography is the science of making ciphers, and cryptanalysis is the science of breaking them. And if you do both, you do cryptology. So the International Association, which represents all the cryptographers in the world, is called the International Association of Cryptologic Research. Even though everyone in it is a cryptographer.
So I think you're one of the first, maybe not the first guest, but you're one of the few guests that we've had on that aren't necessarily coming straight out of the blockchain space. Uh-huh. But my question is, what is your interaction with the blockchain space? Because I understand you have done some work with groups.
So first you've got to understand that blockchain isn't cryptocurrencies. So there's two mantras in cryptography is crypto means cryptology or crypto means cryptography, not cryptocurrency. And the other one is blockchain does not mean cryptocurrency. Okay. So blockchains have a lot of applications outside of the cryptocurrency space. And also in terms of corporate land, a lot of blockchains do not necessarily need proofs of work. So you can do, so what proof of work gives you in something like Bitcoin is it solves the consensus problem. But there are other ways of solving consensus problems if you have so-called provisioned blockchain. So there's a lot of applications around that use a blockchain as, but with provision services. And basically there, what you're doing is you're using a blockchain as a, what's called a, like an append-only database. So it allows you to do database applications, which are slightly simpler than using standard distributed databases where you have issues of locking and unlocking, etc. Yeah, so I've been advised a number of companies in this space, in mainly in the financial sector.
That's interesting. Have you, so you've touched a lot of these quote unquote private blockchains, but have you touched anything in the public space? I mean, there's like Zcash and a lot of these newer, fancier things.
Yeah, okay. So I haven't
touched complicated crypto.
So I haven't explicitly worked on any of the public blockchain applications like Zcash. But I know the people behind them and we all talk to each other. And so, yeah, so it's a very, very small community who know what's going on.
Particularly Zcash, I think. I mean, we're going to be talking today about MPC and they have a very, very famous case of using MPC.
I think, yeah, I think in the blockchain community, the first, you know, thing that made people in the blockchain community understand what MPC was doing was the Zcash opening ceremony, which was, you know, kind of an interesting one-off application. But what you're actually seeing, especially in return to when you go to cryptocurrencies, is crypto custodianship. There's a lot of applications now there for MPC to do authorization and signing operations, which are more efficient and match the application much better than previously. So cryptocurrency is good in that it generates lots of interesting, unlike normal financial institutions or normal companies, they are definitely early adopters of high tech.
One thing our listeners may be noticing is the way that we're pronouncing MPC.
Yeah.
And not saying MPCs, because as I learned recently from Nigel, that's actually very incorrect to use MPC in plural, NPCs doesn't make sense. So tell us why that is.
Okay, so when you talk about a zero knowledge proof, it's a thing. So you can talk about plural things. So you can talk about zero knowledge proofs. So you can talk about ZKPs. So that makes sense. Whereas MPC stands for multi-party computation. Therefore, it's a technology. And if you pluralized it, you'd be talking about multi-party computations. And therefore, you're talking about something that's a processes that's going on rather than a technology. So if you want to talk about the technology and pluralize it, it's like you might have a piece of software that does one version of MPC and another version of software that does MPC. These would be two MPC systems. So, yeah.
Got it. Thank you for sharing that with us and for clarifying. I know that I think we and others in the space have made this mistake a lot, and so this is good to know.
Yeah. Whenever you have initials, it's always good to understand go back to what they actually stand for to decide whether you can pluralize it or not.
Can you say FHEs?
Well, you can talk about FHEs if you're talking about the ciphertext, because they're encryptions. So if you take an encryption of X and an encryption of Y, then they are encryptions. But they are, you're actually talking about the specific encryptions of X and Y. Whereas if you want to talk about FHE as a technology or different types of technology, you talk about FHE technologies.
Like if you're saying MPCs, you're talking about the actual computations that are taking place.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We did an episode on MPC on this podcast before, and if I'm honest with myself, it's probably not the best intro ever, but...
It was just you and me. It was just myself and Frederick, so this wasn't like we're putting any guest under the bus here.
But I'm curious to hear from you, Nigel. What would your, like, short introduction to just explaining what MPC is be?
Okay, so imagine you've got two sets of data, or three sets of data, or four sets of data, and you want to compute a function on the joint data without revealing what the data is. And you do this via a protocol by doing a computation. So it's multiple parties, multiple pieces of data, doing a computation on their joint input And the only thing you learn is the output. So a really good example, a practical example that's used is hospitals. Hospitals have information on patients, and you might want to do some medical statistical experiment. So you can do a medical statistical experiment on the joint data of the hospitals without each hospital having to reveal the information about their patients.
What would that look like on the sort of technical front? Like, would that actually be each hospital like running something on a computer? Like, what would that look like?
So it looked like each hospital would have their own separate database, and they would have computers that attach to the database, and the computers would pull data from their own database and then engage in a protocol with the other hospitals. And at the end of the protocol, out pops the statistical answer you want. And what doesn't pop out to either hospital is the other hospital's data. And this is mathematically guaranteed this doesn't pop out. So it's, no matter how much, the hackery you do, you're guaranteed that there's no extra information that jumps out.
Does it also, I guess it also guarantees that the information that is shared or that like that metric is correct.
Yeah. So you also get correctness of the results. So you can't protect against people lying. So if one hospital lies about its data, that's all you can do. But you can prevent a hospital, one of the hospitals, doing the wrong calculation. So they all agree on the right calculation. They have to both do the same calculation.
So in our introduction episode, we covered MPCE from the perspective of like solving polynomials. Like that's our fundamentals that we go into. Would you say that modern MPC systems are still like fundamentally, constructing and solving polynomial equations, or has it moved way beyond that?
It's not just solving polynomial equations. You can do any computation. So from the 80s, we knew that anything you can compute in the clear, we can compute securely. Yeah. So if you have any computation you want to do, in theory, we can do that computation. In practice, that depends on the technology and what you want to do. But in theory, we can compute anything. So a really good example that was done in a US government program a few years ago is satellite. There are two satellites going around the Earth, and sometimes satellites hit each other and it's really expensive. Okay. But what you want to do is you want to avoid, make sure the satellites don't hit each other. On the other hand, countries aren't really very keen on revealing where their satellite actually is.
Yeah.
So you can imagine the fact that the satellite's going over a country, you might not want to know that. So you could actually, what some people did in that US government program I was involved in is that they actually did an MPC calculation where you had one country knew where its satellite was and what direction it was going in, and another one was, and you would work out whether the satellites were going to hit each other and whether they should change course without revealing the positions of the satellites. So you could do computations which are like Newtonian mechanics. Other examples could be, we're engaged in here. I don't know, your listeners may not know this, but we're actually in three different countries here. So we're in three different countries. And actually, when you do a merging audio, you actually have a problem. So, if you have encrypted communications, you actually have to decrypt them to merge the audios for group conversations. So this is actually, the same US government program, we actually had encrypted communications from three voice communications from three different sites. The voice communications were encrypted, but then merged, where you merge the audio files and then send them back out in real time during the conversation. So that's kind of like what Skype currently does is you connect to Skype and it will merge the three together by decrypting and having to do the merging on the fly when you do a group conversation. Because that's actually quite hard, but we managed to do this in a secure domain.
Those are amazing examples.
Yeah, really, really cool. So you can really see that this has applications. So we talked about healthcare. We talked about military applications, with satellites. We can talk about voice applications in the cryptocurrency space. You can secure your cryptographic keys for signing you can take your cryptographic signing key. You can split that up and put those in different servers and then use those, and then do an MPC calculation to actually do the digital signature. So there's the key is never in one place. It's much more secure. You could have this one signing key in Berlin, one signing key in America, once part of it in Japan, and they never come together. So this has solves the problem of where do you keep your cold and hot wallet keys?
Wow, that's super interesting. Is that actually, does that exist? That's not like...
That exists.
It sounds like a multi-sig, but I feel like it's a
different thing. It's not a multi-sig. Yeah. It's better than a multi-sig because a multi-sig requires the recipient to know it's a multi-sig. So it looks different. Yeah, and it also, a multi-sig, suppose you have a multi-sig which says we're going to take three signatures and combine them. Then what that actually tells the verifier is that your authorization policy was three people had to agree. And you might not actually want that to happen. So what we can do with MPC is produce what looks to the verifier like a genuine signature, looks like a normal signature. And then, but from the signer's point of view, it has been composed of different secret keys with different authorizations. So it could be, that you allow me on my own to sign a transaction. But Anna and Frederick have to get together to sign it because we don't trust them too much. Okay. So they have to come together. So we could have what's called an access structure where you have two people have to sign or one person. And similar things have been used, not in sense of MPC, but that kind of access structure is used for nuclear command and control. Yeah. So launching nuclear missiles, you require the president and the submarine commander, or the vice president, the submarine commander, and a general or something like that. You need a combination. So you have these different access structures, and you can do that within the signature on a blockchain in a way that the verifier doesn't know what your authorization policy was behind, which could be company confidential. And then is this deployed? Yes. Unbound Tech produced tech in this space, and it's actually deployed in a reasonable number of the very large cryptocurrency exchanges to secure their cold and hot wallet keys. And it also means that they can do greater volumes of turnaround and less delay for consumers.
I actually think there's some application. We've talked about Bitcoin bridges in the past, and like a constraint in Bitcoin is that you can't have multisigs above a certain number of parties. Yeah. But in a bridge, you might actually want a multisig of like 1,000 parties.
Yeah.
And you can't do that natively on Bitcoin. So you would have to do something like this.
Yeah, so yeah, exactly. That exactly solves that problem.
Would you say, I mean, are MPC systems the focus of your research? And have they been the focus of your research? Or was there something else that you were working on before this?
Oh, before this, I was doing all sorts of stuff. I've done, so originally... I worked on what's called, I worked on things called elliptic curve cryptography. This was back in like the late 90s, early 2000s, where we looked at ways of breaking elliptic curve cryptography and stuff. And then there was this big boom in the early 2000s on what's called pairing based cryptography, which, is used in, some blockchain applications. So for example, I think, Definity, I think is a big user of, pairing-based crypto in some of its applications. And then worked on key agreement, all sorts of other things. So various things. And then kind of in the mid-2000s, there were kind of two things. So I would always turn up to MPC talks. You know, plural, it's talks. There we go. Because they're talks about MPC. So I would always turn up to MPC talks and fall asleep because this was just so boring. This was just like, this was never going to be practical. MPC had been around since the 1980s. It was very, very theoretical and no one would ever think you could ever use it. And then in the mid-2000s, I think it was like 2004, I think it was, I went to a Eurocrypt, which is the main cryptography conference for Europe in Interlaken in Switzerland. And at cryptography conferences, we have something called a rump session. Now, a rump session is an event in one of the evenings where people drink a lot of beer and a lot of wine, and people give two-minute talks. And they're just giving two-minute talks, which are either funny, an advertisement, or they're demonstrating something. And one guy got up, and he actually, in 2 minutes... live gave a demonstration of MPC working on his laptop. Now, in a 2 minute presentation where you have to get the presentation onto the stage and actually get it running and working, you go like, oh, this isn't theoretical anymore. This is real. And then, the next year, there was a Eurocrypt, this time in Aarhus in Denmark. And at the same thing at the rump session, someone got up and said, actually, we've used MPC to do a real calculation in the real world for real people, which is what's called, which was the calculation, which is now famous in the MPC community as the Danish sugar beet auction. So you can't mention MPC without mentioning Danish sugar beet auction. And at that point, I went, aha, it really is real. And then I kind of like shifted. And then I started working with Yehuda Lindel, who's the other co-founder of Unbound Tech, and also working with Benny Pinkers, who was the guy who'd given the rump session talk at Interlaken. And we started actually then sort of building MPC and seeing whether we could turn the theory into practice. And to give you an idea, we did the first very large scale, what's called actively secure, which is like the gold standard of security computation in 2007, 2008. And we calculated a specific function. It doesn't matter what it is. We calculated a specific function. At that point was the first time anyone had ever done it. It took hours.
Wow.
Hours. And now that same calculation can now be done in milliseconds. So in 10 years, the performance improvement has just dramatically dropped. And that's why it's become so hot.
I sort of want to go back to that beginning, that early MPC work that you were doing. What was that actually? What did that look like?
Well, okay. So for me, okay. So, I could talk about the community or for me. So it's kind of like different. So in the community in the 80s, people were just doing pen and paper, you know, they were doing thought experiments, you know, what would happen? So the first example is mental poker in some sense. How could you play poker by telephone? So I've got a bunch of cards. You've got a bunch of cards. We've dealt the cards. I don't know what your cards are. You don't know what my cards are, but we want to play poker and not cheat over the telephone by just exchanging cryptographic messages. So people were just playing mental games like that. And they came up with this idea of MPC. And then in the 80s and early 90s, people were just playing with the idea. What could it theoretically do? Could you compute anything? And it turns out you can. You could theoretically compute anything you want securely, which is kind of cool. And then maybe from the mid-90s to the mid-2000s, people were kind of coming up with ways of doing the computations, but they weren't really very practical. And the networks weren't very good at the time, and computers weren't so fast, et cetera, et cetera. And then, like, in the mid-2000s, computers were just about fast enough that you could do something really basic. So I think the idea... there's this famous example, which came up in the 80s, which is called the millionaires problem. So imagine you've got two millionaires and they want to work out who's the richest. So they want to compute. They've both got their inputs. So one input, one millionaire's got the value X, one millionaire's got the value Y. And you want to work out, is X bigger than Y or is Y bigger than X? And that's all you want to compute without revealing X or Y. So the only information, so you've got two millionaires, Alice and Bob. Alice will learn maybe she's the richest, and Bob will learn he's the poorest, but we won't know by how much. So that's what's called the millionaire's problem. And what this guy had done in this rump session in Interlaken is run the millionaire's problem on 16-bit integers. So which is a number, which isn't even a million. That's like less than 65536. Yeah. So this is comparing two numbers less than 16 bits, and it took 2 minutes. That's just the length of his talk to compare the integers. Yeah. But that's where we were. But as soon as you could do something, as soon as you could actually implement something and play with it, you would then implement it and you go, aha, I can make this go faster. I can make that go faster. I don't need to do this. I can change that. I can use this part of the infrastructure. I can use the operating system in this way. I can use the network in this way. And suddenly the improvements come rapidly, you know, one on top of each other.
So what you just talked about is sort of this bridge or this gap between research and engineering. And we've talked to people on the show before about this, and it's always fascinating to me. What I see is exactly what you said, that once there's something out there to play with, that's when you start attracting the engineers. And once you have the engineers on board, they can go, well, actually, I can speed this up a little bit. I can do this over here. And you start having the hackers actually like improve the technology. And then you start working more hand in hand. And that's when you get the real improvements. you know, how do you see the role of like engineering and the programmers coming in and working with the theorists?
Well, I think the thing is, certainly in this area, actually everyone's hand in hand. There's still some theorists doing theoretical MPC in the world, but almost everyone's now doing a combination of theory and practice. Is that because you can't, so you have a new idea to improve some protocol. So you have some new weird and wacky idea. Actually testing it on paper, you can't test it on paper because in the real world, everything works on, you know, what's the network latency, memory issues, bandwidth. And these systems are now so complicated. They have so many moving parts that you can't really test whether something's real or not, or whether it gives you an improvement without actually implementing it. So a lot of the theoretical research now is hand in hand with, engineering research. And also the engineering research requires the theoreticians to, you know, solve problems, or you do a piece of engineering and you go, oh my God, that's something we never realized. And then you pass it back to the theoreticians. And they go, oh yeah, they kind of measure the wrong things. And then you suddenly realize that you've got one thing you're meant to be measuring in the theory world doesn't actually make sense in the practical world. And there's this, a never ending combination of, you know, theory to practice, practice to theory, and so on. So maybe 10 years ago in the crypto community, that's crypto means cryptography. Always got to get that in. Always got to get that in. Crypto means cryptography. Okay. In the crypto community, there was a bit of a bifurcation between the theoreticians and the practitioners. But I think a lot of things over the last, you know, 7 or 8 years have actually brought them together. One of which has been this huge explosion in MPC applications and practicality, which suddenly the theoreticians are going, woohoo, our stuff's useful. and the practical people go, woohoo, we've got something else to play with. And then there was the huge explosion in fully homomorphic encryption. And then also we've kind of created, community places for people to come together. So I founded, along with someone else, Kenny Patterson, this thing called Real World Crypto, which we run every year in January. And it turned from being like 7 years ago, it was like a tiny event with 100 people. It's now the biggest cryptography conference in the world. You know, it's, we have like 700 people turn up, and we have people from the cryptocurrency space. We have people from academia, we have people from government. We have, you know, the crypto teams of Apple and Facebook and Google and Microsoft turn up. We have people from who are interested in public policy. Last year we had people doing MPC, doing a really interesting survey in Boston, which is the Boston Agenda Survey, where they got 200 companies to do a statistical survey of whether there was a difference in pay between male and female in the different companies. And so they got all the companies to put their data into this MPC system to do the statistical analysis. So we're seeing all sorts of, you know, public policy stuff coming out that's really bringing people together.
You just mentioned sort of the FHE idea. Yeah. I'm not going to say FHEs here. FHE. Actually, the way you've defined the MPC, it sounds very, very similar to the FHE, this idea of this ability to combine things and almost anything.
Yeah.
In the work that you're doing, I mean, do you see the work on MPC as a silo, or do you actually see that blending in with a lot of these other concepts?
They're very, very similar. In fact, they actually are really related. Okay, so the thing with the usual use case of FHE is that's pretended that people say is you encrypt some stuff, you send it to the server computes on it without knowing what it is and sends it back to you. So you think about an encrypted Google search. You encrypt your search term, you send it to Google, Google gives you your search results, but doesn't know what you've searched for or what your results are, sends them back and you decrypt. Okay, that isn't practical, but that gives you an idea of what the idea is. Now, that really is like MPC, except there's only one person doing the computation, the server. So it's okay. FHE is MPC without the M.
Wow.
So which is the really easy way to think about it. So it's very, very similar. However, they're not separate. So one of the big breakthroughs we had is we have an MPC protocol called SPEEDS, which is spelt SPDZ for the authors, which is Smart, Padraig, Damgard and Zacharias. So usually in cryptography, you put things in alphabetical order, but someone realized that if you reordered our names, it would be speeds, because it was a really fast protocol.
And that's, those are awesome. Like Nizik and Dizik and Bulletproof.
Exactly.
Naming is important.
Naming is really, really important. We have, actually, whenever we do something, we come up with a really cool name to make sure people remember it. So speeds, everyone remembers. And this came out in about 2012. And what speeds does is actually it uses FHE to do MPC. So it uses it uses a form of FHE, which usually people go, that's totally impractical. But we use FHE to actually make things go faster than if we didn't have FHE. So we can we use FHE within the MPC calculation as an accelerant to make it go faster.
So to dig in a little bit more and get, like, I want a better practical understanding of how these MPC systems work. So maybe we take speeds as an example and, like, explain how that protocol works.
Okay, so imagine we've got three of us. We got myself, we got Adam, we got Frederick, and we have some piece of data. So imagine, don't worry about putting data into the system or out of the system. Just think at the moment of how you actually do computation. So if we have a variable in a program, let's think of the variable, call it X. So what we do with that variable is we split it into three. And we write X as X1 plus X2 plus X3. So Anna gets X3, Frederick gets X2, and I get X1. Now, because remember, they're untrustworthy, if Anna and Frederick get together, they're the least trusted, right? So if with just X2 and X3, they can learn nothing about X. It's only the three of us together know something about X, okay? So in my piece of data, when I'm running the program, I only hold X1, Frederick only holds X2, and Anna holds X3. Now, suppose we have another variable, call it Y. We have Y1, Y2, and Y3 in the same way. Now, if we want to add the variables together to get Z equals X plus Y, then all that I have to do is go Z1 equals X1 plus Y1. Frederick goes Z2 equals X2 plus Y2. Anna goes Z3 equals X3 plus Y3. And then miraculously, Z is actually Z1 plus Z2 plus Z3 by the magic of maths. Okay, so that turns out, well, so what that means is what's called linear operations are for free, is that you don't have to do anything clever to do linear operations. So addition is a linear operation. Multiplication by constants are linear operations. So the only difficulty seems to be doing nonlinear operations. Now, the simplest nonlinear operation you have is multiplication. Yes. Well, after you do addition at school, you do multiplication. So for multiplication, there's all sorts of complicated ways of doing multiplication. And it's very hard to do on a podcast because you need lots of blackboards and stuff. But what speeds does is it uses homomorphic encryption to enable you to do the multiplication fast. So instead of using the homomorphic encryption to do an arbitrary computation, which is very expensive, we'd use the homomorphic encryption to just do a very simple operation, which is multiplication. And that means that we can make the multiplication go very fast. To do the multiplication, we have to communicate data. So I send some data to Frederick, I send some data to Anna, Anna sends some data to Frederick and Frederick sends some data to Anna and me. But so this data is transmitted around, but this data reveals nothing about the actual underlying secrets. But then we can produce a multiplication. And it turns out that any computation that you can think of can be written as a sequence of pluses and multiplies. Okay? So we just then need a compiler, which takes our program, turns it into a sequence of pluses and multiplies. Not quite. This is simplifying it a bit. And then we just run that, and then we've got our secure computation.
So you basically use, as you described before, FHEs to, you know, operate on this very small domain where it's really fast and therefore can speed up the complicated part of MPC.
Yeah, exactly. So that's one way of doing MPC. There's another way of doing MPC, which is due to Andy Yao, which is called Yao circuits or garbled circuits. And here what you do is you represent the function as a binary circuit, just like it would be on a microprocessor on the chip in electronics and silicon. And so it turns out there you can represent everything as a bunch of ANDs and XORs and ORs and NOT gates, yeah? And here what you do is that you actually produce the lookup table, the truth table for the binary operation, you actually form an encrypted version of the truth table. And there, what you use is you use a standard cipher like AES to do the encryption of the truth table. And then when you evaluate the computation, you are basically decrypting parts of the truth tables and working through the circuit. So there's kind of two different ways of doing it. There's the secret sharing approach of speeds. And then there's the encrypted truth table approach of garbled circuits.
Since you've actually been working in the space for a pretty good amount of time and you've seen this develop, I would be really curious to hear what you think of some other maybe comparable systems or systems that have been compared. You might not think of them in the same category. But for example, we actually not too long ago also did an episode on TEEs.
Okay.
TEEs.
Yeah.
Can we say TEEs?
Yeah.
Can I pluralize that one?
Because it's an environment. TEE is the thing. It's the thing. Yeah, yeah.
Good. Okay. So I am very curious to hear, what do you think of TEEs? And do you see a relationship between TEEs and MPC? Because we've often heard them lumped together or compared. And I wonder what you think.
It's kind of interesting. Okay, so a TEE is a trusted execution environment. So as we see it now, it's something like ARM Trust Zone or Intel SGX. Actually, if you go back to the very first paper on fully homomorphic encryption, which was in 1978. Okay, so this is a long time ago. In 1978, the paper of fully homomorphic encryption by Rivest, etc. They had two ideas in this paper. The first idea is, wouldn't it be good if someone could invent fully homomorphic encryption? Because then we could compute on data without seeing it. And then they said, but that looks really hard. So why don't we just encrypt the stuff going into the microprocessor? And they said, well, what you could do is you could put a little encryption device as the data goes into the microprocessor. So the registers in the microprocessor are in the clear, but as the data comes out, it's decrypted. It's encrypted. So it's decrypted going in and encrypted going out. And then he went, and they also said, but that's also a stupid idea because actually, this was 1970s technology. The best cipher they had was DES, which was terribly slow, even in hardware. And even microprocessors then were faster than the DES. So they couldn't get the data in quick enough and out enough. So that was considered a no-go. So what's kind of interesting is when FHE started becoming interesting in 2009, when Craig Gentry came up with the first FHE implementation, first FHE idea. At the same time, people also revisited this idea of putting a little encryption device on the bus going into a microprocessor to encrypt stuff coming in and out. And of course, now with microprocessors, actually it's the bus is the slow thing. So slowing it down a little bit by just AES encrypting stuff doesn't really cost much. Okay. Because getting data in and out of the processor is the slow bit of the computation. So now, and that's then led to TEEs like the Intel SGX. So they are historically absolutely come from the same source. So very similar. However, Intel and the others made a very interesting decision when they decided to build the TEE. So inside a microprocessor, it has to make decisions. And as it makes decisions, it leaks power or it leaks radiation or it leaks heat or sound or whatever. And so they explicitly excluded from the TEE design these what's called side channel attacks. And therefore TEEs are only trusted if you trust no one to actually monitor the device and break it. So there's
what you just said there about the energy and heat coming off it. Are you talking about that idea that because you could track spikes in heat and energy consumption, you could potentially crack?
Yeah, you can see it.
What's in there?
You can see it. That's okay, right.
Crazy. So that's so cool. That's so cool.
And the banking industry has known this for ages. So maybe some of your US listeners are kind of have only just got a chip and PIN card for doing transactions, or there's chip and signature in the US. In the rest of the world, we've been using chip and PIN for about 20 years. And the chip and PIN cards, the banks have known that the chips could be broken by measuring power consumption and electromagnetic radiation for years. And so there's been a lot of work to actually secure chip and PIN cards against these kind of attacks. So this is big business. It goes back to the 60s. People would program these big computers in the 60s and they would know what was happening in the computer. They didn't have debuggers. GDB did not exist. And so what you would do is you'd listen to the computer and you would go, it would go like, oh, it's stuck in loop 4. because you knew the sound of the loop of what the computer sound was making by actually the sounds coming out. So this side channel attacks were actually used as debuggers in the 1960s.
Wow. And so TEEs, as we're talking about them, those are not protected against
They are
this?
Not protected against side channel attacks as a deliberate design decision. So if you put your trusted execution environment in the hands of the bad guy, then it's...
And they have the right tools,
and they have the right tools, they can... So, yeah. So this is one of the problems with TEEs have. And it's a deliberate design decision. I think the assumption is if this TEE is running in a cloud server, you don't trust Amazon to, you trust Amazon not to put a lot of electromagnetic radiation equipment to measure around the server, because that's already, but you probably don't want the data in the clear on the Amazon server itself or Microsoft server or whatever. So they have advantages, TEs, but they're not the panacea that everyone seems to. Okay. Let's just face it. No technology is a panacea, right? So MPC has a problem, FHE has a problem, TEs have a problem. Everything has a problem, but TE's problem is side channel attacks. Yeah.
Well, that and the fact that they have this attestation thing, so you actually need to trust Intel to attest to whatever you're doing.
Yeah, because otherwise, how do you know it's actually a real TE? Yeah.
It's funny to hear you say like it's not the panacea that everyone seems to think it is, because In my bubble, in the space that I move, everyone hates them. Like no one wants to use them. No one wants
everyone hates everything. So let's just say people really love something or they hate it. It's kind of like, I'm English, so we have this thing called Marmite, which is something you either love or hate. Yeah. So all technologies, all technologies Marmite.
Yeah, that's true.
Another idea, this is more maybe in the zero knowledge proof camp, but you know, because there's snarks and snarks require a trusted setup and a trusted setup, an MPC can be quite laborious and requires some sort of social organization. And it can actually be potentially dangerous that, you know, this, what did you call it? The random string.
The common reference string.
Yeah, that the common reference string could actually be discovered somehow. Yeah. So that poses a danger. So we see new systems coming out where they've actually removed the need for an MPC, like Bulletproofs and Starks. And I'm wondering what you think about those.
Okay, so the reason you want to use these things is because you want to do zero knowledge proofs of complex statements. And you want to do that efficiently. Now, the question is, what do you mean by efficient? So efficient could be fast for the prover. It could be fast for the verifier. It could be low communication cost. The size of the proof is small. And each one of those three technologies optimizes one. And so the goal is, you know, the perfect zero knowledge proof would be fast for the prover, fast for the verifier, and no space. Yeah.
And no setup.
Yeah. So you have these different competing things. And currently the level of technology is we don't know how to do all good things at once. Mm-hmm. So you basically, these Starks, the Bulletproofs, etc., and snarks and whatever, they all optimize different things. On the other hand, there is another technology to do zero knowledge proofs called MPC in the head, which is really, really funky. So,
is it actually called MPC in the head?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Okay, so. The idea of, so let's go back to our example where I want to prove some arbitrary statement to you. So what I do is I run an MPC protocol myself between two parties, say, in my head. So I'm both Alice and I'm Bob in my head. And so, but because I know everything, I'm the prover. So I run both parties in my head. And then the proof is that you, the challenger, send me a challenge that says open Alice. And if I know the statement, it's the only way I can open Alice correctly is if I actually know the value I'm trying to prove correct. And so there is a zero knowledge proof technique called MPC in the head, which doesn't require setup assumptions. It's quite slow. It's quite large, but, you know, quite big. But it can do anything really, any statement really, really efficiently if you can write down a circuit for it. And it actually forms the basis of certain what's called post-quantum signature schemes. So one of the big things happening in crypto at the moment is post-quantum. And one of the, post-quantum signature schemes called PICNIC that's been submitted to the NIST competition is actually based on MPC in the head. So there's all sorts of different, everyone's kind of trying to find different ways of doing better zero knowledge, but it's basically speed of verifier, speed of prover, size of proof, and trusted setup assumptions are the things. And you always have to give up one.
I think it's interesting to look at an example like the millionaire's problem. If we go back to that, like you could have a zero knowledge proof in any system that says, yes, Alice has more money than Bob.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And like in a bulletproof system, it would be expensive to produce that proof. It might be pretty large. So it would make total sense if you want to prove to many people many times over time that Alice has more money than Bob. But if you're just trying to prove it once to Bob, then it doesn't make sense to go through all this trouble, and it might be better to have an NPC to do it. Or if you're trying to prove bunch of pairs in this system, like setting up a new trusted setup for each pair, it's way too complicated and expensive. So you need something else. And,
So you have different applications, domains, whatever.
So I think this leads us to our last questions, which is about like the future of these systems. So maybe you can tell me what, other than the NPC in the head or in my head, what was it? NPC
in the head.
In the head.
In the head. Yeah.
Sounds a little bit like a 90s rap song or something. What other new kinds of NPC systems or NPC setups or techniques are you seeing emerging?
Okay, so one of the big, I think in terms of NPC, it's kind of, the basics are kind of done, and we're just getting more optimizations. I think people are interested in what happens if there's a quantum computer built. So there's a lot of move to what happens for, in the case of quantum computing, making sure systems are secure against quantum computers. And that brings on to a whole thing that really, really touches the whole of the crypto, both cryptography and cryptocurrency space, which is what's called crypto agility, is that you've seen in the last 10 years, problems with ciphers and algorithms having to be retired. You know, MD5 was a hash function that was used everywhere in Windows. And this caused real problems for Microsoft having to remove the thousands of places it was used. And we kind of need to be able to have, how do you change a system which is already deployed quickly? So we're currently, TLS 1.3 has currently been standardized. Trying to deploy it is quite hard. Actually, you know, it took ages to get rid of everybody to get rid of SSL3, despite everyone knowing it was rubbish. You know, deploying new systems when things are broken is hard. Imagine blockchain, right? So imagine the hash function's broken. Okay. How are you going to have to change all the hash functions instantly? So then it's not built into the system because it's built on consensus and the consent. How are they going to agree on changing the hash function? How are they going to agree on changing what digital signature to use? Now, if you go this elliptic curve based on this, whatever it was, the Koblitz curve, I can't remember which number it is. Yeah. That's used in Bitcoin. What happens if someone breaks that curve? You want to change everything overnight. What happens to all the signatures that have already been made? All of them are invalid instantly. Because you could have forged any signature, yeah? So you could have kept your, you don't know. So how do you do this crypto agility on systems that are deployed? And people haven't really thought about that very much, so.
Would that almost fall under the category of like upgradability?
Yeah, yeah. So
is that how you'd call it?
Yeah, upgraded. So it's called agility so that you can move, you could shift. So you can quickly shift your cipher from A to B if you find out it's broken. And so I think, when people built the internet and the early systems in the 90s, they went, it's 90s. It's not going to last very long. It's just going to, we're going to just deploy some stuff and we're going to replace it very quickly. So they didn't really think about how you could upgrade things. And then this kind of habit got built in and engineers to go, we're going to use this piece of crypto. It worked. Boom. And then you see millions and millions of devices with, one device might have 1,000 pieces of crypto calls within it. And you've got to kind of isolate all of them. If the algorithm is broken, you have to isolate all of them and replace them. It's a real, real problem.
It's a huge problem, not only in crypto. Like, if Bitcoin had to change its hash function, I mean, it would be, it just wouldn't happen. I can't even imagine what would happen.
Like, but they should be thinking about this now.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And, I think Ethereum, when it launched, it was a lot more agile. It was a lot more we know that things will change. We're thinking about, quantum computers, and they're trying to think about it. But it's still over time has stagnated, and it's almost to the same level as Bitcoin and like not wanting to change. So it's like a lot of the next generation of blockchains now are thinking about upgradability and like how do you keep an agile protocol, but it's super hard. It's like a fundamentally difficult question.
Yeah.
I guess it's not only difficult technically, but also just socially. Like people, there's so much resistance from community.
And also there are, you know, people who are a little evangelical about their favorite algorithm. You're going to use algorithm X because it's the best thing ever, you know, and they won't, they won't shut up.
That's so true. And it's so funny. Do you see this in academia all the time as well?
All the time. It's really, really, it's really a pain.
So you kind of mentioned earlier on this post-quantum work. When you mentioned this sort of the Bitcoin hash function could be broken, like, is it post-quantum?
No, the Bitcoin hash function, the Bitcoin signature scheme is not post-quantum. The Bitcoin hash function is in some sense post-quantum in the fact it's a hash function, except the Bitcoin hash function is based on what's called the MD family. Now, MD should go, you know, light up bells because that's MD5. It comes from the same stable as MD5. It's a tweaked version of MD5. It's a more complex version of MD5. So it's called SHA-2. And SHA-2 is based on SHA-1, which is based on SHA-0, which is based on MD5, which is based on MD4, which is based on MD2. And they have been broken in order. MD2 was broken, then MD4, then MD5, then SHA-0, then SHA-1. And now we're on SHA-2. And they're going it's only going to take a matter of time. It might be 10 years. It might be 1 year. It might be 100 years. But it's the same family. It's the same technique should apply. It's just a more complex version of something that's already been broken.
Do you believe that actually everything that's being created today, it will be broken.
Everything will be broken. The question, So the US government already reacted to this. So there is a SHA-3, and SHA-3 is from a completely different family. So SHA-3 looks to SHA-2 like AES looks to DES. They just look different. You know, so the attack techniques you'd use on SHA-2 do not apply to SHA-3, and SHA-3's a much more interesting algorithm. You can use it for much more different things. So that was created by some Belgians. I now live in Belgium because Belgium is the home of cryptography. So your listeners may remember that AES comes from Belgium. So hopefully SHA-3 comes from Belgium. So our hope is that the winner of the NIST competition for the post-quantum algorithms will also come from Belgium, because we think that just should be the definition, is that good crypto algorithms should come from Belgium.
But in the case of Ethereum, what's used there?
So I'm led to believe it's using Ketchhack, which is SHA-3. So that's a different one. And hopefully we'll get microprocessor support for SHA-3 in the next few years.
There's a funny story or like oddity of the Ethereum protocol that Ethereum uses Ketchhack 256, which is SHA-3 before it won the NIST competition. So it's SHA-3 went into NIST and like had from Ketchhack 256 to SHA-3, there was a small tweak, and some like hardcore Ethereum people when this was going through was theorizing that maybe this tweak was applied by like a government agency to try to inject some knowledge or something. So they stuck with Ketchhack 256.
There's a good story there about DES. So DES was modified between the submission and the thing, and everyone thought it was because the US government had modified to make it weaker. Actually, what happened was the US government modified to make it stronger.
So to wrap up, what would you say that you're looking forward to the most over the coming little while? Like what new technologies, new projects, whatever it may be?
Okay, so cool things that are coming up is the excitement of the NIST post-quantum crypto competition. So who's going to win? Is it going to be Belgium? Is it going to be someone else? And of course, they're saying it's not a competition, so there's not going to be a winner. And you're going like, yeah, right. Everyone's going to still treat it as a winner. And so it's really important. And so that's going to be like what people settle on for encryption and signatures. I think there's a lot of work on zero knowledge proofs and proving those. We've really touched on. I think a lot of people think, you know, MPC in the head, I think, might be pushed a lot further. I think applications of MPC in the real world are going to really take off. We're going to see lots of, you know, we've already touched on a number in this podcast, and I think there's going to be a load there. And then there's like really weird and wacky stuff, you know, like, the cryptographers always come up with this, you know, things. There was this idea a few years ago called indistinguishable obfuscation, which is a way of obfuscating code. I could give you the code and you don't know what the code program does. It's kind of, but that's kind of died a bit in terms of research at the moment. But these things keep popping up.
One of the things we've noticed is that a lot of times something will be developed. It'll be kind of exciting, but maybe not yet useful. It'll die down and then come back in some new form. Is there anything in like early research that you would love to see come back?
Oh, I don't know.
Be picked up?
I think the thing is if it was in early research, yeah, it's kind of weird in that the fact is that you go back and you go, oh yeah, duh. And,
it was actually there.
It was already there. So for example, we already talked about trusted execution environments. We're already in the FHE paper, you know, and you go like, but everyone forgets it. And so actually, if I knew what was kind of cool in the past, that's what I would now be doing.
Well, then I guess that suggests we should be on the lookout.
Yeah. You got to look out and things come back and, it's kind of an interesting, you always see new things. The world resolves and you get new things coming. The old things come back and they look like new.
So what are you working on next?
Or
now?
Currently, we're working on some MPC in the head ideas to do more efficient serialized proofs. We're looking at improvements for MPC protocols. We have so our speeds protocol, we've embodied it in a piece of software called Scale, S-C-A-L-E, which we're now maintaining and using that in a number of applications. So people can download that and play with that as an MPC system. We're always looking to recruit new people. I mean, the whole area is really hot. There's not a single cryptographer on the planet who hasn't got a large number of job openings. So if anyone listening to this would like to come and work in Lerven, which is the biggest crypto group on the planet, we have the inventor of AES. One of the inventors of AES just works down from the corridor from me. So whatever we have work on Bitcoin and symmetric ciphers, privacy, and everything is going on in Lerven. We've got about 70 people working on cryptography just in Lerven. So if you're interested, please just drop us a line and come and work with us.
Thank you very much for being on the podcast. It was a pleasure.
No problem.
Very interesting. And to our listeners, thanks for listening.